Then I'll reconvene the hearing. Ms. Hutton, we were talking about
noise
provisions.
Okay, had a look at the chapter 36 and the council's right of reply version. It looks like within chapter 36, when it was first notified, industrial was one of the zones that was in the table in terms of having a noise limit that applied to it under chapter 36. Submission was made by Bunnings, submitter 746, requesting that it was removed and was industrial activities and noise in relation to industrial activities was assessed as part of the stage that dealt with industrial activities. So the reply version has industrial crossed out. So in terms of this zone, there's, I guess, a couple of choices. If we did, we could either leave some sort of noise provision in here, like we've got in the other industrial zones, and when that part of the district plan review is amends the industrial provisions and hopefully change puts noise within chapter 36, it varies if by chance this chapter was to make it into stage one, then it varies this stage to have that noise consistent with all the other bits of the district plan, which is painful. Yeah.
Well, I think you're making it a little complicated.
Okay.
If we look at page...
Or just introduce it in there.
Do you have the council's reply version?
On my phone, I was looking at it.
Yeah. If you look at page 36, which is table 2.
Yeah.
And it says, zones sounds is received in. And then it says, low, medium density, high density, large lot, rural residential, rural lifestyle, etc., Jack's Point.
Mm-hmm.
At any point within any site, 50 dBA. So
it's receiving. Yes.
That this would be any different from that.
No, so as long as the noise, any noise emitted from the Cohombian area when it reached the Jack's Point zone was not over 50
or
dBA.
I think you also...
Zone.
I think you also
rural
find
zone
if you go back a page...
I didn't hear that in the list.
No, it's not in that one, but in the previous page, the national boundary and the rural zone is the same.
Okay.
The national boundary of a residential dwelling, or
yes,
not to the rural zone per se,
no,
but a residential dwelling in a rural zone.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the national boundary of a residential unit within the rural zone.
Yep.
So, and so what you're really saying in terms of these specific provisions, do you see those as provisions that could apply within this zone if we were to recommend that they're included? Or
that's consistent to that.
In other words, the sound received in this zone is 60 dBA.
The sound received in the rural general zone? No,
the Cohombian industrial zone. Is that what you're seeing there, or were you seeing that there'd be no noise limits within the zone itself?
My understanding of the other industrial zones, how they work, is that there's no noise limit within the zone itself.
Right.
So comes to the zone with without necessarily an expectation that they're going to have the benefit of those noise limits.
Yeah.
But the noise produced from within the zone to areas outside of the zone certainly should be subject to acceptable limits to the receiver.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm. but so much so I can remember.
So, so we probably need no change to chapter 36 at all.
That's
and we
good.
Should probably delete this entirely.
Is that seems perfectly acceptable, sir.
So 18.5.7.
Yeah, it's deleted. Yeah.
Hmm. And now looking at rule 18.4.1.5, custodial units.
Yes.
Are you intending with that rule that there be no custodial units essentially?
I don't think there'd be as many as, say, custodial units that are in Glenda Drive because of the amount of the list of requirements that they have to have.
But if you've got the activity status as non-compliant.
If you don't meet all of the following requirements.
Well, no, that's not what the rule says. The rule says that the activity status is non-complying even if you do meet all the
others. Complies with all
those. Complying with all those.
Yeah. Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, yeah. How... Sorry, that rule's been there for a while and I hadn't thought about it in that way. Usually for industrial zones, industrial service zones, and where I was with the work I did for Plan Change 19, you wouldn't anticipate any residential activities because of issues such as reverse sensitivity. This area is quite different in that there isn't potentially going to be nobody living in the area. There might not be any sort of passive surveillance, sit 10 type stuff over the 24-hour period. So if there were people that did want to live within that zone for a custodial purpose or because of the hours of operation, I wanted it to be a very high test for them to be there so that you didn't end up with reverse sensitivity type issues later on.
So, is the very high test the following requirements that you've set out there in A to E? And if you met those, then what activities then do you think they should be?
Yeah, I do. It's a non-compliant activity, so then you've still got the tests of the objectives and policies. And
well, no, well, yes, but that says to me that it's not going to happen because you have to get a non-compliant activity consent even if you meet all the very high standards you've set there, which suggests that it's an expectation that you won't satisfy the objectives and policies.
And
you can ponder that one.
Yeah.
I would have thought the likelihood was that if you meet all those, you were probably permitted.
In fact, when you look at the policy you've written on it, ACN 212, it's not a very high two. Wouldn't be too hard to demonstrate that you've achieved that, and then you're through, when you're straight through 104D. And after that, once you're through 104D, an occupy activity isn't a very hard test at all.
This
comes down to effect.
I would have thought, given that policy, that rule could be permitted, because you have to meet all the standards. If you didn't meet the standards, then the problem you have, you do, well, if you don't meet the standards, then your residential activity doesn't meet
which
that.
Is prohibited.
Well, unfortunately, it was that, though, from experience in Christchurch, to see where they had a rule like that, and it was hugely abused by people putting in a notional single garage size so called factory or workshop, and it was really just cheap and nasty accommodation.
Mm. Well, we're short. I don't think you'd be able to manage that under those A to E, though.
No.
It just seems that there's a.
I think in the genesis of the zone and the provisions, we wanted to have the ability to have some custodial residential use, but appreciated the extent to which it had been abused. In Glenda Drive, for example, where every premise had industrial use but a residential use above, not necessarily for custodial purposes and hard to monitor, etc. So it was trying to find a medium between making it a very hard test and high threshold to meet.
Well, that still would lead me to a restrictive discretion, right?
We might have been too hard on ourselves with non-complying.
Well, I think you've made an impossible test.
Yes.
Because even if it goes through section 104 to D, you get the discretionary, and you have to say, well, and weighing it all up, that's saying that it's very rare and might end up with less than you expect.
Can I just ask a question too? This rule appears to be focused at a custodial unit attached to an activity rather than to a site. And you see, if there's no minimum site size in the second area, then there is the prospect of having quite a small activity area with a custodial unit attached. So I wasn't quite clear whether the aim was to attach it to the activity or attach it to the site or both.
Yes. How it's written that it could only be occupied by persons who are living in the or working in the industrial service activity to which the unit is attached, I guess presupposes that there is already an industrial activity happening there for it to do that,
So what if somebody wants to do everything, if they want to apply all at the same time, which is common these days, with a subdivision or a unit title plan and get to the... I like my fellow commissioners, I don't think we're anxious about the custodial units happening, and the probability of them being desirable in this location is small, isn't it?
I would have thought that with Glenda Drive, to be honest. I was on the council side, and I've been part of the monitoring for Glenda Drive. I've been on the other end of the phone when industrial activity owners are ringing up and saying, well, the neighbours next door say that I have to stop at 7 o'clock. It's what I was trying to do with this role is I do have a bit, as a planner, a bit uncomfortable in having residential uses in the only zone that is geared for people to do things that are a bit noisy, a bit undesirable. So I just want, it's like people going and living under a flight path. It happens and then they complain. I want something there so that if you are living in that environment and find it not appropriate, that there's some tests that you've gone through to be there. The other converse example of that is I'm aware of a consent a fellow planner was working on in the industrial zone for a trucking company where they wanted to put a couple of beds in so that people could sleep on site after a shift and then move on to their next job. But because of the strictness of the industrial provisions under Plan Change 19, that wasn't even an option. So there's, I don't know, it is a hard balance, and I would be, as long as there was some, I think there does need to be some high threshold in terms of what is appropriate for the ability to live out in that zone.
Can I just ask one other question? What enforcement did the council do in Glenda Drive? Knock on doors and say, show me your payslip?
No, there's no trigger like that at all. There's nothing. You can go and rent a... If I want to take my family and go live in one of those custodial units, it doesn't have to be... My relationship doesn't have to be related to what's happening underneath me.
How would you propose to enforce this one?
Well, you would... If somebody was... if there was a complaint by the person about noise levels, well, do you work at the activity to which underneath you are complaining about? I'm sorry, we're not going to give your complaints any credence because it's within this role.
I don't think you can do that.
They won't be complaining about their own boss, it'll be the guy over the fence.
Yeah.
Well, is the concern reverse sensitivity?
Yeah.
Or is the concern using industrial land for residential purposes?
Yeah, that's
both.
Definitely both. Especially if it's cheap, you don't want it to be the new affordable housing area, where you will create even more problems with reverse sensitivity over time.
To overcome the problem we had in Christchurch, you could put in a minimum floor area for the industrial premises, because the bulk of people there, they were putting up so-called small industrial units for small companies, but they were only the size of a single garage.
Well, 100 square metres for a residential activity is quite large, believe it or not. You wouldn't believe it with the average size of buildings, but it's a three-bedroom house.
I think Commissioner Mallett with his comments about policy too, if you don't stay non-compliant, you better have some objectives and policies that say what you mean. Because
yeah.
I didn't divine that background to this rule from reading the objectives and policy. It could be quite a desirable area with lovely views.
Yes. And while we're on, is there anything else on that?
No, that's it.
While we're on that page, the wilding species, isn't that rule unnecessary to be chapter 34? Chapter 34 is notified.
Yes.
Made all wilding species prohibited.
Yeah, I think I'm correct in that. So this one's obsolete. Yeah.
Now I'm going to get really picky now.
Yes.
If we look at your objective, first objective.
Which objective?
The first objective.
Yeah.
18.2.1. What in that tells me that it's a yard based activity zone?
Nothing on the objective.
That could provide anything, isn't the whole point of this to provide a particular type of industrial zone servicing a particular niche, as the coachman described?
Yeah, the point of the zone provides for industrial zoning, both that large lot size and for, I guess, normal industrial that doesn't need the larger plot size, the 1A and 2A differences. But I agree that objective doesn't explicitly Yeah, it would refer to yard based.
And well, and as a, I need to serve the local area, local and surrounding area.
Well, I thought it was not just about what the local and surrounding area. Is it the whole of the Queensland? Is it the South Island? What is it?
Or is it just Fox Point? But well, maybe if we go back a step, look, why don't you enunciate to us what you think it needs to achieve as an environmental outcome?
It is a to provide for industrial and yard-based industrial activities to meet a need within our district. Within the district, sorry.
So just to be amused, what if somebody had a little business making something quite benign, was making something for export to Thailand? How could it go there?
It can.
No, you don't, because it's nothing to do with the district, other than the employment of people who.
I guess we have
not meeting the needs of the district.
Mm.
Well, maybe it depends on what meeting the needs of the district means, and that I think is where Mr. Mountford would say. Is the needs the product of it, or is the need
the land for those employment opportunities that industrial land contributes to? Yeah.
Another problem, which are the two objectives sufficiently different?
No.
No, well, but now we've got close to the second one.
Sorry, I put it here.
Sorry, but what you've announced here gets close to the second objective. We're not trying to be difficult about this, but it occurs to us that if there is to be a change in industrial zone, it needs to be have a properly formulated set of objectives and policies which identify the purpose of it being there and how the activities within it are controlled to achieve that purpose. That's what objectives and policies are about,
yes.
So my understanding. And none of us want to spend all afternoon going through them individually.
But there are two or three things I wouldn't mind highlighting.
Yes. But and that's obviously something that Mr. Buxton and yourself could talk about as well, that are probably more fruitful if we raise some questions that was a matter of because that we don't want to have to write a plan, if you don't understand.
Just one extra way of using it. It's crazy, the magic.
we're just discussing scope of changes, but that's all right. I'm sure that was happening as
I think that the release thought was so broad that the details of the words probably.
Yes, I agree. Yes.
No. Oh, I was just going to give a couple of hints. In policy 18213, ensuring that built form within the zone are not highly visible when from state highway. Miss Snodgrass uses a particular categorisation of visibility, doesn't she? From negligible to low to moderate and so on. Not highly visible is actually a very slack test given what she gave in her evidence. So, you know, it would be at most moderately, I think, when you're looking down Wilson's yard, isn't it, through the gap in one of the roads. So that's just reading to take care of. In 18.2.1.7, to minimise the visual effects of the development within the zone, isn't that a similar policy in that it's actually working on the visibility of the buildings in particular and the site generally from far away as well as from close up? So I could see some tidying up being done and some using of Ms. Snodgrass's language to be a bit sharper. Mm-hmm. And I have questions about the prohibited activity status at some stage, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is that off the policies for
a moment? Yes, yeah, okay, you go then, Mrs. Malford.
I had a problem with 18215, which is the office one. To limit the location of office is fine, but to avoid reverse sensitivity and the use of valuable industrial land, was that really your purpose? I mean, how are officers going to create reverse sensitivity to start with? And we were told this morning that industrial land isn't particularly valuable compared to other forms of business land, so wasn't it more about limiting the effects on the true business commercial centres?
Well, I think the term valuable is an ambiguous term, because what you mean is the supply of industrial land, not the value of it.
But wasn't there a point about not allowing offices there because they're locationally they're better off in the Queenstown town centre or the zones of Franklin, because they're more useful there, more accessible, and
it entirely depends on the type of office that you are wanting to establish. Essentially, I think a lawyer's office, you definitely want to be in a town centre, close to councils, close to the people that you're serving. If you were, say, a surveyor and you had a number of vehicles that you wanted easy access in and out, you don't want to go to a public car park, you have equipment that you're carrying in and out of, then an office environment, like an office park, Coneburn might suit you quite well.
On the other hand, the strategic direction policy, objectives and policies are quite clear that commercial activity should be focused on, in this area, on Queenstown and Franklin.
Yeah.
So isn't that really where you should be flowing down from those policies rather? And I should say the surveyors and Monica are in the town centre zone.
There's always examples.
Not in the rural zone.
Well, exceptions on this side of the hill. You're pushing the bounds.
There is a policy along those lines in 18.2.2.1b. So
yes.
I think there's a bit of reordering and sharpening up to do.
Less is sometimes best with objectives and policies.
Mm-hmm.
Concise.
Back in 2.1a, well, who would do that anyway? Was there a history to that one?
Yes. In terms of creating lots that can't accommodate the rules for the zone, yes, Glenda Drive is a prime example of that.
But how is that achieved when you've got no minimum lot size?
Yes. Because at the time of subdivision, you've got to prove that a building to the, I guess, at most case, restricted discretionary size can be put on that lot, as well as working out the GFA of the number of car parks for staff and visitors that correspond to that area and where your loading is on that site. And if that site can't achieve all of that, then you wouldn't get that subdivision consent, that lot size. The planner would be saying it's not big enough. And that's what's used in Plan Page 19 at the moment, and I've applied for subdivision consents where I've proven to the planner processing, here's a mock-up of a land use activity on the site and all of the effects can be absorbed within the site. It's just an extra sort of test that you need to do at subdivision stage.
So just looking at that provision in the subdivision, that's 27 rules, you would prove 27.8.2.3 presumably.
Yes.
What would be the status if you didn't meet that?
That's a controlled activity. I think it's not complying for that time. For chapter 27. Yeah. Yeah. I can check on that off the top of my head.
Yes.
Does this mean that you actually have to have the land use and the business lined up, or does it just means the building rather than the land use?
You just have to be aware of the land use rules when you're designing the subdivision.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other
so a 50 square metre lunch bar and a 100 square metre custodial unit and how big a site do you need?
Well, for the 50 square metre lunch bar you're still going to have your parking and loading, so it's going to be probably 150, 200 square metres anyway to have that, yeah.
And is that the kind of outcome you're looking for?
In terms of lot size.
Mm. And we're thinking about this as a yard-based activity zone, specialising in those yard-based activities because they are being displaced from other industrial and commercial zones due to the cost of land and competition from commercial and retail activities, not to mention the trade supply.
Within the structure plan, there are two types of industrial activity that are provided for, one being the yard-based and the other being the other industrial, which could go to that smaller size. Your yard-based activities are always protected for that purpose in the sense that you've got that 3,000 square metre lot size, whereas within those other parts of the structure plan, you do have that flexibility to go lower. What the rules are trying to achieve is to make sure when you do go lower that there is some thought at subdivision stage as to how the activities within those lots can occur, essentially.
So if we're going turning to the structure plan itself, I take it the yard-based ones are the bigger ones out loud of pink. Activity than the 1A.
What is the area of
1A? Because I noticed the 2A are much smaller. Much smaller blocks, which is consistent with what you're saying.
How much land in activity area 1A? Because if the purpose of the zone is to do something specialised, you'd want to make sure there was enough of it.
It looks to me like 1A is the
smaller
area and a series of smaller sites.
Yes, it is too, because they're the blue ones.
They're still quite large sites.
Yeah,
But the majority of the zone is in the 1A.
2A.
Just visually, 2A.
Do we want the land areas for bike paths?
No, on an earlier version I'll have to check with my... Well, we have the land area on them, and I think it's in my evidence, but I'll check. I can't remember numbers off the top of my head, sorry.
I'll do that. I'll give you something to do.
Okay.
If you have an industrial area, which is, given the list of activities, is primarily industrial, in the long term, sites have to be reused, don't they? How practical is it to have something where an early subdivision creates a series of small sites based on a small buildings, maybe 300 or 400 square metre sites, and then activities come along later which actually those are too small for? I'm just wondering whether we've got a different circumstance here from Franklin Flats, where the rather more mixed-use type of zoning scattered through there, and if we have an industrial zone which is designed to be purely industrial, shouldn't we be looking at something which ensures that in the long term there are large blocks available for recycling and for other industrial activities?
Those 3,000 square metre lot sizes will be there, I guess, in perpetuity, if you didn't need...
Yes, but we're talking about the 2A area, which is which is
large
a large area. You know, you wouldn't want to have that subdivided down to sites similar to the low density residential or medium density residential lot sizes, would you? But you could do.
What it looks like. You could do, but you'd have to prove that all of the activities could happen within that site, and I don't think you'd get down that small.
Well, I don't know. That's a controlled activity. It's not a very hard test to show that buildings are going to fit on each one and parking. Wouldn't it be better to create a minimum site size with a restricted discretionary activity to go lower when certain circumstances occur? I mean, the reality is the subdivision will need to consent anyway.
Yes.
There's, in terms of the area, the total area of the zone is 27.25. I haven't found an area for 1A and 2A yet. But I'm looking.
What was the criteria for deciding what was 1A and what was 2A?
The ability to undertake the roading and earthworks required to create the areas.
Well, I can see that. I can see why you'd want to start with your roading pattern on a site like that. But that still doesn't answer the question. Why are the larger areas 2A, for example, when I would have thought that all yard based activity should be in the larger area?
I'm not sure on that. I'm trying to rack my brains for where we were with that.
Well, make a note of it.
2 years ago. Yeah, not you. Sorry, it was. Yeah.
No, well, I was wondering about those sizes because I recall something this morning said that there was 37 was the total area.
Not the zone, yeah.
And the larger area was the open space, and the smaller area was it when you were legal?
Yeah, my
submissions,
I just, yeah.
39.95 hectares of open space
and
roading,
yes,
and
right.
27.25 hectares
yeah.
of the zone.
I didn't distinguish.
And there's
one or 2A. But when you think about it, the shortfall of industrial zoning They're somewhere in the order of 11, 15, 20 hectares.
I can provide those, but not quickly, without you sitting here watching me shuffle through lots and lots of paper.
Excuse me. I just noticed my evidence. I was writing it down. If I can.
Thank you.
At paragraph 27.2, I refer to 5.32 hectares for area 1 and 21.93 hectares for area. That's 2. So 2A. And 2A would be 21.93 and 1A would be 5.32 hectares. That was at paragraph 27.2 of mine.
Because that's the order of the thing.
Yes.
Paragraph 27.2.
Sorry? Paragraph 27.2 of my achievement.
Thank you.
Seems to be saying it might need to be scaled back anyway to control the traffic generation.
Yes, Mr. Butt was saying that in terms of building coverage, and that's why we reduced that through this process.
So that's been his opinion has been factored in,
yes,
to what you're presently.
Yes, exactly. That's why we've got the controlled activity, the permitted building coverage, and then if you want to go higher than that, it's restricted discretionary based on those, I think, 5 points that were in my summary evidence and within here. So the need to have a bigger building and the effects on the transport network.
Prohibited activities, and this is Ms. McDonald, this one might be for you. Usually the environment court sets very stringent thresholds when deciding whether or not to make something prohibited. There's a number of prohibited activities proposed here. What is the basis for that when you're thinking of a section 32 AA justification that the panel would have to make when doing its recommendations? And just by way of a hint, we've been having a bit of a discussion as to whether or not you can take an OSHA-like approach when somebody offers to do prohibited activities. Can you accept it?
Well, starting with that point first, I would say that yes, you can. I think that,
you can. That
in a plan change context, that's a bit different than applying it to a resource consent context where the principle has normally been applied. But again, though, yes, it would need to be justified in terms of your Section 32AA assessment, because whilst that status will become enshrined as a rule in a plan and can't be changed without a plan change, someone coming back in the future to seek to change that status is obviously going to be, the council wants to be able to point to a robust Section 32AA report to resist a future change or challenge on the basis that it was offered up by the applicant, and well, it wasn't really justified from an effects based perspective or what have you. So I think that robust assessment in terms of that Section 32AA is very important to support that status. I guess in terms of the status that's been offered up in terms of prohibited, particularly around things such as retail and residential. Unfortunately, despite writing the strongest possible objectives and policies that we could for Plan Change 19, they have not withheld scrutiny of the consent process. So there's a real, very real concern that non-complying just isn't going to provide the protection, if you like, of this industrial land from being overtaken by other competing uses. And I was involved in that process, and it was long and rigorous and very careful in terms of the objectives and policies that were written, and they passed some very high scrutiny, I have to say. The judge and the commissioners involved in that process, but again, disappointingly, consents have been granted where they was Hush and I passionate about this, where we feel that they shouldn't have been. Yeah. So then,
if you were sitting in the panel seat and looking at what to write in the recommendation to support prohibited activity categories, which pieces of evidence would you rely on in order to do that?
Well, all I could point to is, the only place it would be covered is in this Huffman's planning evidence and in the Section 32, and it may well be that there isn't the comparison with the Plan Change 19 experience, the practice experience that I've just referred you to in her evidence.
Can I have a reference to the part of the evidence in chief that covers prohibited activity? Or covers what I need to know from Section 32?
Well, it's I'm
pretty sure it does.
There's a cost-benefit analysis that's been undertaken to support the rules. Just find a reference to that.
Is that the table?
Yes.
In the evidence in chief, the table at 5.1.
No, sorry, I was just looking at my Section 32.
Okay. I just want to make sure I can triage that one.
I just got it.
You too,
I am not sure where I discuss that or if I do it.
I don't recall there being prohibitive activities for officers in retailing any new evidence in chief. I thought this came about today.
Correct. Yeah.
Is it that you've got it listed as policy 18221, but it looks to me like it's actually about 7 or 8 policies. Is that the policy basis for the prohibited activity status, those activities?
Yes.
Could you? The policy basis in
yes.
the, in here?
Yes.
Yeah.
18221, yeah. Actually, it seems to me that it's at least 3 policies, but it may be more. It says other than ancillary retailers.
Yeah. Provided for that purpose.
Is employed in order to do various other things.
Yeah.
But then it's, it seems to me that D is actually a separate matter, not one of those reasons. And so is E.
That's the policy basis, but where's the evidence that you can dong to back up that policy? which bits of the evidence support that? Are they mainly Osborne and Copeland, as Mr. Copeland reconciled them this morning on the subject of competition for
competition.
Industrial land that's in short supply,
yeah,
and the displacement and so on.
Yeah.
Well, the only place you've discussed it in your summary today is in paragraph 9.
Yes, that's correct.
And you've referred to council evidence.
Some policies which are clear and focused on enabling yard-based activities in particular, they have a positive face, which is what you're trying to achieve, and then they have the other face, which is what is to be avoided.
Yeah, to avoid.
And so a good policy framework is needed for prohibited activity standing and activity status, and I just would like to see that with 2 or 3 key bits of evidence, I think, to support the prohibited activity, because I'm just, look, as a planner, I'm wary about using that category. I've seen it used for the, on that church in Russell, Mr. Chair, the famous one that was the first ever church built in New Zealand or whatever. Really otherwise seen sets in historic building preservation cases, an odd mining thing. So rare.
Whereas, I don't know, we've used it in Plan Change 19 recently. We used it quite a lot.
And how did you substantiate it? That's what I'm really asking for, the similar substantiation.
I guess there were policies such as to avoid
such in the case of that SN's activity sensitive to aircraft noise, so the prohibited status.
Yes,
was
I have seen
that.
It. Prohibited activity status used in that case, yes.
So that was for visitor accommodation and stuff in that zone. That was residential as well within both the industrial area subject to the air noise boundary and outside of it because of that protection of industrial land for industrial purposes. And those were prohibited status, and I think the examples of the non-compliant status that were used, and Bunnings might be an example of that, they're still being applied for.
Interesting plain construction arguments, did you?
Yeah.
Do you have any further questions, Mr. Master? Just while he checks, I just want to check that you consider this to be urban development. Do you?
Yes, I think it contains all the characteristics of urbanness, constructed roads, subdivision, neighbour upon neighbour.
Then that's because you've got such an extensive suite of policies, I suppose.
Yes, and in the proposed plan, there's not a lot of use of assessment criteria at all.
Yeah, that's actually a plan design feature.
I quite like assessment criteria, but it's not in the new plan format so much.
There still are other examples in this case.
We don't have any more questions, Ms. Hutton, but I think it would be valuable if you and Mr. Buxton use the opportunity of caucusing and a joint statement that maybe could answer the questions that were raised. And that in terms of that, we would really appreciate that coming in probably by the end of the week, if possible. Just the council needs sufficient time to do it for reply, of course.
Would it be helpful if that joint statement included the sort of analysis supporting use of prohibited status, for example?
It would be very helpful. Especially if both of you agreed on it.
Yeah, if we both agree, or we'll state if we don't.
Well, what's just one other matter? You haven't amended the section. You've amended the provision substantially. You haven't amended the section 32.
No, it does need to be done. Yeah.
Well, I think that's any joint statement.
Yeah.
To deal with that. And I mean, if there are any differences, identify them.
Yes.
And the reasons for those differences. Yeah. I mean, differences of opinion. And then on that basis, I'll adjourn the hearing. This is the very last hearing that we're going to have on this stage because.
Oh, good.
We'll be doing that later this evening.
Yes, well done, I have to say.
And I'll adjourn on the basis that there's extra information to come in for minutes, and I'll deal with your issue that you raised this week.
Thank you very much for your time.